this week's program, a conversation with Aaron J. Kernis. Astral Artists alumni will perform the premiere of a specially commissioned work by the Pulitzer Prize-winning composer tomorrow afternoon. Susan Lewis considers the Italian artist and designer Roberto Cappucci, whose work is now on display at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And a settlement music school celebrates the opening of its newest branch. We speak with the school's executive director, Helen Eaton. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Tomorrow afternoon, alumni from Philadelphia's Astral Artists Advocacy and Training Program for Young Musicians will perform a new piece for harp, flute, viola, soprano and percussion by the Pulitzer Prize-winning composer Aaron J. Kernis. Astral commissioned L'Art del Danza as the culmination of a two-year-long stint as composer-in-residence for Kernis, a Philadelphia native. Aaron J. Kernis is among the most successful and prolific living American composers. The 51-year-old has written music in virtually every form except opera or ballet and has been commissioned by many of the world's leading orchestras and foremost performers, including sopranos Renee Fleming and Dawn Upshaw, violinists Joshua Bell, Pamela Frank and Nadia Salerno Sonnenberg, and guitarist Sharon Ibsen. I met with Aaron J. Kernis backstage at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall yesterday morning and first asked him how he had come to be the composer-in-residence for Astral Artists.
Back when I was a high school student, I had applied for a scholarship through Astral and had met Vera Wilson back then. And while I didn't get the scholarship, she remembered me all these years and noticed my work over the years, and about 3 years ago called me and suggested that Astral have their first ever residency with me, and I was completely delighted.
You're working with musicians at the early part of their career. How does that affect your approach?
Well, the musicians are amazing, and they're really already at this young age at the top of their game and so experienced and so nimble. And I really have seen that they can pretty much do anything, and I've really felt very, very free to both have some of my most challenging works played by them and write a big new piece for these terrific alums of the Astral program.
And in terms of the new piece, were there any parameters? You've written pretty much everything except, I'm thinking, an opera and a Broadway show?
And a ballet, but that's coming up
okay. Next.
It's true, I haven't done opera, and I keep on making, heading in that direction. And
it's surprising, because you have sort of hit around it at times.
Yeah, and I'm thinking again about trying to get in there and head in that direction again. This is a funny situation, because I was given a bunch of recordings and information about past Astral artists, the newest ones, and I chose this, what turned out to be a very challenging group of instruments to write for. I thought, oh, you know, harpists have over the years asked me for something. I thought this will be a chance to deal with that. So it's a piece for flute, harp, viola, soprano, and percussion that was added kind of as an obbligato. And writing for harp was really hard. And
just trying to balance it with those other instruments, I imagine, must have been an incredible difficulty in the first instance.
Well, they're very strong, actually. The three instruments together as a group, a very intimate sound, but I think they can balance very well with each other. And it's really a song cycle, and I found I needed a few instruments that either could sustain the chords I wanted or kind of touch on the Renaissance influences I wanted to bring forward from the percussion.
Is it fair to say that you are a melodist by nature? You write very strong melodies. Is that the starting point for you?
I like that you've mentioned that. That's a term I'm very happy with. And I do think first of line and of melody. And I was first a singer. I was first a choral singer. And I can say I've been most attracted by vocal instruments like the violin, the cello, things with a singing tone.
And that's the starting place then. And I did once ask a living composer who shall remain nameless for this point about where the inspiration came from, and he told me it was money. I'm not going to ask you about that, but what's the starting point? Is it waking up in the middle of the night and hearing a line of melody? Where is it coming from?
Well, a lot of my process begins in an intuitive way. When I decided on this instrumentation, the inspiration came from needing to do something very different from what I'd done in the last 5 years or so. And that was a piece with dance rhythms, a piece with a more light and cheerful and joyous spirit. And some little intuition told me that I should look at Renaissance dance. And I began to explore that and think about dance forms, and then found this fascinating volume of texts that are dance treatises from the mid-1400s. And that's where I pretty much found the majority of the texts in the piece.
How do you know, and this is probably a really dumb question, how do you know when A, you're not repeating yourself, or B, you're not repeating somebody else?
Well, if I'm repeating myself, it's very clear, because I pretty much have in my build-up kind of adult DNA, if there is such a thing, my works, I kind of hold them in my body in a way. And so if things come back, often it's deliberate. There are some quotes actually in this piece that come through the text of some earlier works. Occasionally a person will come to me and say, oh, you know, the tune in this piece is very similar. And a lot of times I'll use similar intervals that for periods of time concentrate on particular motives that may turn out to be related. In terms of
unintentional borrowings, shall we call them?
I think more are intentional. As I'm going through the process, a lot of the agonizing in the process comes when I've written a passage and I say, you know, this sounds like Strauss, or this has some harmony like Brahms. And then I'll spend a few weeks thinking, get rid of it, keep it, you know. And I do both. Sometimes I'll throw stuff out for that reason, but more often than not, it's come out of a process. And it's usually fine if it touches on other composers' influences. And there's actually a lot of Monteverdi in this piece for me. That's kind of first time. So I was listening to really early, early Renaissance dance music, which is pretty simple stuff and gets really interesting in the early 1500s, early dance music, and then, you know, flowers completely in with Monteverdi. And some of the lines really come out of Renaissance lute music, Renaissance vocal music, and then later some allusions to Monteverdi. But there's some little bits of Brahmsian harmony and little tiny hint of Tchaikovsky, you know, and it's just come through the process. I hate to X stuff out when I see it come organically out of the musical process.
You say that, but I've kind of immersed myself in your music in the last 2 or 3 days, and I'm pretty sure now that I could identify an Aaron J. Kernis piece, blind tasted, so to speak. Are you aware of what the Kernesque touch is? And do you ever have to do a great imitation of yourself?
You know, for many, many years, until maybe a few weeks ago, actually, I thought, oh, do I have a voice? I'm not sure. Where is the voice? Because over years I have different strands that appear. I have a strand of a jazz influence that appears, sometimes from the past a pop influence, but more often I think a recognizable kind of melodic aspect and color, aspect of instrumental color. Those are the things I can point to, that they come in and out, they weave in and out of my work. And I had a residency 2 weeks ago at DePaul University in Indiana, where about 2.5 hours of my work was played in 3 days. And then it became really clear. I mean, they did a lot of pieces that were choral pieces and vocal pieces, and the relationships were absolutely crystal clear. And they did fewer of the pieces that were kind of more radically out of that sphere. So I can kind of now say, yeah, you know, I think there is a bit of a consistency.
Finally, in terms of your overall arc of your career, is everything built on everything else?
I'm somewhat impatient, and I never enjoy doing too many pieces in a row that are like the last pieces, and so those similarities are inevitable, so I will do in between one big serious piece a lighter piece or something that's different, something that breaks the energy that was built up. And I think it's so I can stand back and breathe for a little while before plunging back into another related, usually more serious or longer or heavier work. So I see these different layers, and within each layer I think there is a kind of progression. I wrote my third symphony 2 years ago, and there's a way in which I feel my work has led to that piece. And I see it from time to time. When I start new things, as when I found the influence of jazz more prominently, that was a new thing. That didn't feel progressive from other pieces, but it felt progressive from my upbringing and from my background.
Aaron J. Kernes. In a program that features works by Gustav Holst, Lou Harrison, and Erno Dohnányi, Astral Artists alums Jasmine Choi, flute, Bridget Kibbe, harp, Teng Li, viola, and Isela Lorisdutter, soprano, will perform the world premiere of The Art of the Dance by Aaron J. Kernes. The concert also features Susan Babini, cello, Deborah Skirto Davis, piano, and violinist Benjamin Beilman. It takes place tomorrow afternoon at 3 at the Trinity Center for Urban Life at 22nd and Spruce Streets in Philadelphia.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
While Gucci, Armani, and Versace are familiar names even to those who don't follow fashion, less well-known in America is the still-active Roberto Cappucci, the designer who veered away from the commercial circuit to create art. Considered one of the leaders of the modern Italian fashion movement that began in the early 1950s, in 1995, Cappucci was invited to show his art at the Venice Biennale. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to a new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, Roberto Cappucci, Art into Fashion.
Beams of light pierce the darkened gallery, illuminating mannequins, faceless figures of fashion who seem to invite visitors to mingle amidst them. At the start, from Roberto Cappucci's first collection, created when he was still shy of 20, a coat with leopard lining. It is tamer, or at least closer to convention, than what is to come. Glorious gowns of brilliant colors, striking silhouettes with voluminous pleats and folds, and dresses incorporating bamboo, straw, stones, or metal, just for starters. A fashion show? Not exactly, says Enrico Minio, director of the Roberto Cappucci Foundation, which preserves more than 2,200 sketches, 400 designs, press clippings, and other artifacts in a museum in Florence dedicated to Cappucci's creations.
Fashion is recognized as a form of art, of decorative art, of applied art. But Cappucci is a whole different matter. He doesn't come from the world of fashion. He comes from the world of art.
Yet he helped change the way the world thought about both fashion and his homeland, says Philadelphia Museum of Art director Timothy Rubb. It was in the aftermath of World War II.
Italy arose from that, and one of the ways it became prominent in the world was through design. Whether it was Italian art, or Italian automobiles, or Italian fashion, the Italian miracle, the 50s and the 60s, was led by aesthetics and by design, and by designers like Cappucci.
Cappucci studied sculpture, painting, and drawing. He doesn't sew, says curator of costumes and textiles, Dillis Blum.
He's thinking about his dress or dress sculptures in a completely different way. It just so happens he uses fabric as a means to express himself.
So how did Cappucci get into fashion?
He got into fashion quite by chance. He liked to design clothes and costumes and have some of them made too. And in 1951, an Italian journalist saw his work and took it to Giovan Battista Giorgini, who was the man who was promoting Italian fashion at the time.
In an attempt to distinguish Italian fashion in an industry then dominated by the French, Giorgini was gathering designers from around Italy for shows aimed at American buyers, retailers, and manufacturers. When, in 1951, the other designers objected to including the young and inexperienced Roberto Cappucci, Giorgini hosted an event showcasing the young designer at his home. Cappucci's work sold out. He was embraced by the international press. He traveled and his star rose. He worked in Italy, moved to Paris in 1961, then back to Rome in 1968.
When he got back to Italy in the late 60s, he found that the world had completely changed and high fashion was dying. New names were coming out like Armani and Versace, and so he went on doing high fashion.
And after a while, that just gets to be very difficult for him because he really was an artist. He looked at the world very differently and didn't want to be part of the commercial scene.
In 1980, Cappucci, wanting to move in his own direction, stopped participating in the official fashion calendar system. Instead, he created one-of-a-kind pieces. He showed his collection in solo shows in grand settings in Asia, Europe, and the United States, no more than once a year. The chronological exhibition now at the Philadelphia Museum of Art includes highlights from throughout his career, such as the 1965 brilliant red silk taffeta dress with nine layers of skirts worn by American swimmer and Hollywood star Esther Williams.
And the inspiration came by throwing a pebble in a fountain and seeing the concentric circles.
simple silk tunics from his time in Paris, embroidered in fluorescent rosary beads.
So when the lights go off, you only see the embroidery. And this was very famous, and they made the cover of Life magazine in 1965.
He experimented with different materials, adding pebbles, bamboo, straw, and metal. But a big milestone came with a trip to India in 1970.
If you look at his earlier designs prior to that, I mean, you can see the influence of Italian painting, the light in Italy, the Italian landscape. After that, it just is sort of this explosion of how he uses form and color in a very timeless way.
He began using many colors in a single work, just as many colors exist in nature.
You can wear maybe 10 different greens, even if some can clash with another one, but all put together they create their own harmony. It's like a field of flowers. You get flowers of all different colors, but then they do find their own harmony.
There are works from 1995, the red pleated gown that looks like fire, together with one in black and white and various shades of gray that looks like smoke. There are dresses meticulously constructed from separate materials, like the gowns that recall clay.
See, the tops of these two dresses are made by a series of ribbons and ropes that are used for upholstery. They're stitched together and they form a cloth with which he made the skirt and the top. It doesn't exist as a fabric, he created it. They're all shades of golds and browns and beiges.
Or the multicolored dress that resembles a pagoda, with each narrow pleat a separate piece of material.
Every stripe of color is first pleated, then they stitch together and create this rainbow look.
The pagoda dress also illustrates Capucci's fascination with architecture and form. An early example, his 1978 white sculpture dress called Doric Column.
The dress is almost like pure architecture. It's the woman is this architectural form.
Architecture and sculpture in the form of a dress. Yet a dress, in most cases, to be worn by someone, whose shape will necessarily become part of the art. Is the work the dress, or the dress as worn by a woman?
It's a combination of the two. You're not embellishing a woman, but you are building something for her, like a house. But then a house is inhabited by a person, and the person puts her personality or his personality in the house. The same thing happens with the dress. The two things must go together. So the dress has its own personality, the woman has its own personality, and they must combine.
The woman has become part of the garment. She's not wearing it, she's part of it.
Capucci then took his work one step further, creating not sculpture dresses, but dresses that are sculpture, never intended to be worn.
They took them into a direction where he didn't really worry about wearability, but he's always made dresses, so if he has to make a sculpture, he makes it constructed as a dress.
In fact, the entire exhibition could be viewed as sculpture, Philadelphia Museum of Art director Timothy Rubb.
The closer you get to these objects he's created, then you look at the color, the choice of fabric, the interaction of light with color and texture. When you look at the construction techniques he's used, particularly in the later dresses where he's focused on pleating, they are remarkable tour de force, technically as well as artistically.
Sculpture inspired by everything?
From everything around him. He listens to music, from landscape to his travel experiences. He just absorbs everything and it just comes out as a Capucci.
This exhibition tells several stories of a country rebuilding itself after defeat in World War II, of an artist straddling the worlds of fashion and art to make his own mark, and of a contemporary dressed-down culture which still delights in the glamour of a beautiful gown.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Roberto Capucci, Art into Fashion, runs through June 5th at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Kerry Zhang and Stacey Chang, students of Sandra Carlock at Settlement Music School, performing Debussy at this week's dedication of a new branch of settlement in Willow Grove. The three-story, 25,000-square-foot facility replaces its former Jenkintown location and includes studios for individual music instruction, dance, chamber music and music therapy, as well as a library and a 320-seat performance hall. It's been a year of change for the now more than century-old Settlement Music School, which provides community arts and music education in six locations in and around Philadelphia. Construction of the new $8 million branch was funded by Settlement's $25 million centennial campaign, money from which has also gone towards scholarships, programming and renovations at other branches. Settlement has also been working under the new leadership of Helen Eaton, its executive director, for now nearly 7 months. Eaton, who studied viola at Juilliard and music history and theory at the University of Chicago, was associate director of operations and dean of programs for 5 years at the Merritt School of Music in Chicago, a large community school of the arts with a mission similar to that of Settlement. Prior to taking the helm at Settlement, she was executive director of the Chicago Children's Choir. I spoke with Helen Eaton earlier this week at the dedication of the new Settlement Music School branch in Willow Grove. Your career path prior to Settlement suggested that you were made for Settlement and Settlement was made for you. At what point in your own music career did you see that this might be the path you would take?
I'd say when I was a student at Juilliard, I'm a violist, and I became involved in teaching, and I saw just the profound impact that it has on the students. So when I moved to Chicago, I started working at the Merritt School of Music and then subsequently at Chicago Children's Choir. And that's where I discovered community music and the tremendous impact that it has on a grand scale.
Tell us of your experiences in Chicago and what you learned there that you brought here with you, do you think?
One of the things that I got to see is that when an entire community comes together to support community music, to really raise the funds that are necessary to provide scholarships and financial aid for any student who wants to study music, that it can really change families' lives. And that's what I experienced in Chicago, is getting to see firsthand the profound difference it can make when communities come together and give of their time, give of their dollars to really support these community arts programs.
It would seem that the public school systems throughout the country have let go of the idea of arts and music education being fundamental to the overall educational experience of children. To what extent can places like Settlement take over that role?
Well, I think it's incredibly important to support the public school system and the arts education that is currently there. I know Philadelphia is working enormously hard to make sure that their arts programs remain. So the role that I see is really a partnership. What can we do to support the music teachers within the public schools, and that if their students are interested in pursuing music after school, getting even more exposure, perhaps playing chamber music in large ensembles, anything that can enhance what they're doing in the public schools, that's our job.
You've been in this job now just over 6 months. What were you expecting and what's been different?
The school is such an interesting organization. There are so many facets to Settlement. It is the largest community music school in the country with six branches and really serving six different communities, although they all come together to support the school as a whole. So I'd say it's really getting to know each of the branches and the people who study at the school, the people who volunteer their time to the school, and that's been one of the most interesting parts.
And what was good and what was bad, or what did you say, oh, I would like to do this differently when you arrived?
Oh, I think there's been tremendous leadership at Settlement, and I'm walking into an organization that is so well-developed that I would say there is very little that needs to be changed, really. It's been so well planned out over so many years through the commitment of the board and of the staff and of the leadership that has been here before. So I think it's more, how do we take it to the next phase? How do we bring more students in the building? How do we tell the story of the importance of arts education? So for me, that's absolutely paramount, is how we can grow our enrollment.
The building we're standing in now would do proud to any university or to any small city as the music school. It's a really phenomenal facility. Your predecessor was here for 40 years. If you were to be here for another 39 and a half years, how many of these would you like to see? How many great new branches of Settlement would you like to see? Or is that the agenda?
I think right now the agenda is filling up the branches, is that we do have these buildings that are in really great condition, although we're looking to make improvements to some of our branches. But overall, we have such a fantastic faculty and staff here at each of the branches. I would really like to see the programs develop and add more students. So that's my focus, and about adding branches, that would be way down the line, but not currently.
There's a lot of goodwill in the philanthropic community, clearly, towards settlement. Raising $25 million in a time of one of the greatest economic downturns in living history is a pretty phenomenal achievement. That said, do you think there's enough appreciation of what's happening at settlement in the community at large?
I do. I mean, the experience that I've had since coming to Philadelphia is that there's not an event that I go to where someone hasn't studied at settlement. Every single person I meet seems that they had a grandparent, a parent, a child. They themselves have studied at settlement. So there's a really rich history that has been created over 103 years, and that's what plays into the success of the school.
Great. Well, and like, what would you like to see in the next 5 years if I gave you a crystal ball or a magic wand?
The branch is completely full with students of all ages, of all abilities. We provide excellence in music instruction. So anyone who comes through the door is going to receive the finest music education. If a student decides to go on and study music, I think that's absolutely wonderful. But we have an important role to play in the community, even for the students who do not want to go on and study music as a profession. We are here for everyone. It is a community music school.
Helen Eaton, Executive Director of Settlement Music School. This week's program is dedicated to the memory of the conductor Yakov Kreitzberg, who died earlier this week, aged 51. He had a long association with the Philadelphia Orchestra, guest conducting more than 30 times, and leading the ensemble on a 2003 tour of North and South America when then music director Wolfgang Sawallisch fell ill. And that's our program for this week. You can hear an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and C under music director Rossin Milnoff. The program's associate producer is Eric Brannan. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.